Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Jim, we start with the breathless reporting of MSNBC in general and Rachel Maddow in particular. They got Trump's tax returns from 2005. Two pages worth. So they kind of ratcheted down the expectations game pretty effectively early on. And then finally, Rachel Maddow's show rolled around. She spent around 20 minutes wasting time before actually getting to the two pages, making a whole series of ridiculous allegations about him being under the thumb of foreign powers, the going back for years and years, because, of course, as you point out in the Jolt today, everybody saw Trump becoming president one day and then made this connection between Trump and Richard Nixon.
When Donald Trump declared as a presidential candidate that he would not release his tax returns, he became the first president since the Watergate era to refuse to release his returns. When Richard Nixon said, "I'm not a crook," he wasn't talking about Watergate. He was talking about his taxes. And in fact, he was kind of a crook on his taxes.
So she very much promoted the fact that in the next segment, we were going to get answers about Trump's actions with his tax returns with the absolutely incontrovertible analysis from somebody named David K. Johnston, who it turns out wrote a book about Trump some years ago. And here's the bombshell in the 2005 tax returns, Jim.
And in terms of what's on here, let me give you the basics. Aside from the numbers being large, these pages are straightforward. He paid $38 million in taxes. He took a big write-down of $103 million. More on that later. If you add up the lines for income, he made more than $150 million in that year. Mazel tov.
So what we've learned, at least from this couple of pages from 2005, is that Hillary Clinton was wrong. It's not that Trump didn't pay taxes. It's not that he's not rich. I'd say clearing $150 million in a year is pretty good, at least by my standards. Jim, then the consideration from the left was that only paid 25% in taxes. That's way too low. And then a lot of people pointed out, well, that's a higher percentage than NBC paid, or Obama or Bernie Sanders or a bunch of other people that the left loves so much. So then the argument became that, well, Trump must have leaked these himself. So you'd think Rachel Maddow might have actually looked at this before going on the air with them. But apparently the hype over this was too much to resist.
Well, if she hadn't looked or only glanced at it just moments before air, it would explain a few things. I.e., you know, imagine David K. Johnson, you know, calling her up and saying, "Rachel, I've got his tax returns." And she goes, "Woohoo!" And she tweets it out. And she's excited. And then like 5 minutes before air, he goes, "Here they are." And she looks at them and there's only four pages. She's like, "This is from 2005. He's like, "Yeah. Well, that's what I got." And then she has to kind of tap dance for the better part of 20 minutes there. Once you've got them, first of all, like 12 years ago, all right, like, you know, this is not going to tell us a heck of a lot about what his finances were 2015, 2016. It's only four pages. It's not an enormous amount of detail about his investments. But, you know, if there had been some sort of like, who was the bad guy in the Rocky movie, the Soviet fighter?
Drago.
If Ivan Drago had you know, given him a gift of a couple million dollars, we know we would have made the screaming headline out of that. Instead, the headline is, well, he made a couple hundred and he paid, you know, $40 million in tax. Well, okay, that all sounds really kind of normal for this. We were told that this was the Rosetta Stone of the vast Trump criminal enterprise, right? That this was going to be. Tell us a lot about him. Now, here's the thing. When we in the press like to see a president's tax returns, it's not usually because we expect to find some sort of unbelievable smoking gun of criminal activity. Sometimes you find something a little embarrassing, like Bill Clinton deducting his used underwear, deducting the cost of his charitable contributions of that. Sometimes you can get a little bit of grief, like I think it was a couple of years ago when either Al Gore or Joe Biden both donated in the three figures their charitable donations for the year. They later insisted that they don't itemize all of their charitable deductions. They gave plenty of charities and that stuff. So you get some interesting insight into these people, but we're not expecting to get this. Trump did say he was going to reveal his tax returns. if it were up to me, yes, he would release the tax returns. But that doesn't mean we talk about this like, aha, this is a Zapruder film of the vast Trump-Russian conspiracy here. And for about 18 minutes last night, after Charlie Cook told me I had to watch this and I had to be ready to write about this at the corner if this was a big deal, by about minute 9 or 10, I'm like, okay, she hasn't told us anything telling us that there's really not that much of a big deal here. And it was, you know, the Mano presentation itself was not entertaining. The gradual recognition on Twitter that she didn't have anything particularly interesting was kind of entertaining. I went back and I looked, Greg. Did you know that when Geraldo Rivera opened up Al Capone's vault, it was actually the highest rated syndicated program of all time?
Oh, the hype was phenomenal. I remember that.
Right?
Yeah.
30 million people. That's a really considerable audience for that. I don't know. I doubt MSNBC ratings were anywhere within like 1/10 of that. But, you know, for 2 hours, everyone's like, ooh, we got to watch Rachel Maddow. And we watched 18 minutes of her talking about how terrible Trump was. And then David K. Johnson came on and gave us the basics. And there really wasn't anything that shocking in it. The one, you know, apparently he paid quite a bit under the alternative minimum tax. And get this, Greg, Trump wants to get rid of the alternative minimum tax.
Whoa.
That's the scandal. There's a provision in the tax code that makes him pay a lot, and he wants to get rid of it.
Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, most of us would like to lower our taxes. I suppose you could say, this shows that Trump doesn't want to pay his fair share. But that's very different from the Harry Reid, he didn't pay any taxes, accusations that were flying around like that. So, you know, it was kind of a big nothing burger. Perhaps the most intriguing question now is, where did David K. Johnson get it? He says it was mailed to him anonymously, meaning he does not know the source. The White House was furiously denouncing that this is being illegal. It was illegally stolen, which people pointed out to me on Twitter last night is kind of redundant.
Yes.
If it's stolen, it's pretty clearly illegal. And illegally published. And Rachel Maddow smirked into the camera and said, ha, the First Amendment protects it. That's not illegally published. Okay, that takes one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is, was it stolen? And at this point, David K. Johnson and Rachel Maddow, nobody can say whether it was stolen or not. Now, people did notice in one corner of one page, it does say client copy, indicating that this was possibly from Trump's accountant or maybe a lawyer. Somebody was involved in the preparation of this tax return. Does this mean that it was leaked by Trump? It certainly is a possibility. The kind of the vast, you know, aha, Trump was, you know, behind this all along theory is that this means he's got to know that David K. Johnson, who's a fairly experienced reporter and written about tax code before, covered Trump for a long time, knew that he was going to run to Maddow, that Maddow was going to overhype it, which I strike me as a safe bet, but not a guaranteed bet. So if so, well played, Mr. President. You know, the other speculation is that, well, Trump just released the couple pages of one tax return from 12 years ago where he paid the most taxes. Yeah, maybe he did. I don't think that's a scandal either. This is an endless circle of excitement and intense, you know, speculation looking for a wrongdoing that's kind of missing from the heart of the story. So it was kind of fun to watch the media world for about 20 minutes in breathless excitement and then finding an empty vault. Like Al Capone's.
So, Jim, a lot of hype and nothing really there. Let's move to the bad martini now and talk about a lot of hype and nothing really there. This is
a recurring theme, actually, of today's Much Ado About Nothing is sort of our theme of the day.
Let's go to thehill.com. When rumors started swirling after the election that Chelsea Clinton was considering her own foray into politics, it was met with eye rolls, even from staunch supporters of the family. But that skepticism is starting to fade. Last month, a separate report in the New York Daily News said that Clinton could potentially run for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's seat should the senator decide to run for president in 2020. Clinton has only stoked the rumors further, particularly on Twitter, where she has repeatedly gone after President Trump and his associates since Inauguration Day. On Sunday, she took the opportunity to rail against Representative Steve King for racially charged comments about immigrant babies. The fiery approach has some in Clinton world thinking she's serious about a run for office, maybe not imminently, but in the future. Others caution the time might not be right for another Clinton to enter the political scene. It's only in paragraph 13 where we get to those close to Chelsea Clinton say there aren't any plans for a political campaign, which has led Red State to write the following. This is Joe Cunningham. What excitement does anyone in the media see in Chelsea Clinton? Who is out there pushing for Chelsea to be the savior of the Democratic Party? Who looks around and sees a party laid to ruins by Hillary's disastrous campaign and thinks, I know, let's get her kid to run for office? She is not a thing. Stop trying to make her a thing. She is not going to be the savior of the Democratic Party because no one wants to vote for a Clinton anymore. Everyone is tired of the Clintons. And Jim, as you have pointed out, you've written about this. The Hill, for some reason, is particularly interested in making a big deal out of every tweet that Chelsea Clinton happens to write. There's a desperate attempt to keep the Clintons relevant here, and it's kind of sad and kind of annoying all at the same time.
You know, I did write about this about a week ago, and I'm kind of marveling at this because I can understand why if you spent a lot of time sucking up to the Clintons over the past three decades, and if you donated a lot of money to the Clinton Foundation, and all of a sudden, you know, thinking you were buying friendship with the next president of the United States, and suddenly you've got nothing for all of that. I guess I understand why those people would be really insistent saying, hey, maybe Chelsea will run someday, or maybe Hillary will run for mayor of New York someday. Someday these people will be in a position to dole out favors again. And then our generosity and our efforts to cajole them and to you know, win over their friendship, it will pay off. You know, maybe that will happen. I understand the motivation there. Who at the Hill has this just, you know, hearts and flowers obsession with Chelsea Clinton? I cannot get my head around this, because almost all of these headlines, Greg, are basically Chelsea Clinton tweeted something and it was critical of the Trump administration.
Big so, surprise. Yeah.
Right. What else did we think we'd done? Also, like this, you know, if Chelsea Clinton had, launched this new giant campaign against the immigration orders, or you know, if she was going to chain herself to the location where they're supposed to build a wall in the southern. If she's actually doing something, if there's actual physical action involved in this, if she's, you know, putting together a network of Democratic donors or something, then maybe she's doing something. She's tweeting. Lots of people in this world tweet, right? It's, you know, including the president of the United States. This, you know, by itself, her tweeting that Steve King stinks or Donald Trump stinks. I don't understand what makes this news, and I don't understand why the media is so breathless every time she does something like this. And, you know, for a long time, I was perfectly happy to let Chelsea Clinton go off and live her life and live happily. And the, you know, we all remember, you know, her being kind of occasionally mocked during her father's presidency, and people said, hey, that's not fair. She doesn't have a choice in who her parents are. She deserves a normal childhood, a normal teen years. Whatever you think of Bill Clinton, whatever you think of Hillary Clinton, Chelsea Clinton hasn't done anything to you. Leave her alone. And that philosophy kind of made sense, but then Chelsea Clinton insisted upon stepping into the public arena, sometimes as a surrogate for her mom on the campaign trail. And then, of course, in her illustrious career as an NBC News correspondent. And then, you know, I've been written about this for a couple of years now, Greg, that, you know, she's the keynote speaker at South by Southwest. She's a provost at NYU. Like all of these awards and titles and honors just keep being tossed at her. And on the one hand, it must be nice if you're her. On the other hand, you'd like to see a little more self-awareness. Look, you didn't really earn that, right? People are sucking up to your mom and dad. That's what makes you special. Right, you haven't done anything without your father's money, or your father's name, or your mother's money, or at least the promise of your mother's future influence. And I remember it was Marie Claire or Elle. There was some magazine that had her on the cover, and I was like, you know, Chelsea Clinton's ready to, you know, she's having her moment. And the whole thing that made her having her moment was that she was now going to be one of the directors of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Greg, what are the odds you get named a director at an organization named after you, huh?
Whew.
You think she knows somebody there?
Biting the fingernails till that announcement came down, I'm sure.
I mean, like, I just kept seeing profile after profile trying to persuade us that she was this amazing, extraordinary, inherently fascinating person, and she just isn't, right? There's just nothing that's all that surprising about her, that she does a lot, gets a lot of opportunities. Yes, because of who her mom and dad are. But you thought that the 2016 election might end this. But I think, if anything, it's kind of added this new desperation to these profile pieces. And now she's embracing her Twitter sass and stuff. No, stop it. Stop it. I don't want to quote Mean Girls, but the phrase "stop trying to make Chelsea a thing" just completely fits it perfectly. This is not going to catch on. It's not going to be the hot new trend. Just let, you know, Chelsea Clinton, you deserve a happy life far from the public eye, and go ahead and do that. But she refuses to do it, and a lot of people around the Clintons seem absolutely determined that if they just try hard enough, we're all going to be fascinated with Chelsea. You know what? It's not going to happen. And poor Neon Taster on the Twitter is going to have to count every Hill story for the rest of the year, and it'll probably hit three digits by like midsummer.
All right, let's move on to the crazy martini now, because that wasn't crazy enough. This is from Politico. Donald Trump is only in his second month in the White House, but already one Democrat is polling his party's Iowa caucus goers ahead of a possible 2020 run for the presidency. Who do you think it is? The leadership pack of former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley commissioned a public policy polling survey of the first-in-the-nation caucus state earlier this month, according to a copy of the results obtained by Politico. The poll, which shows O'Malley at 18% of Democratic caucus goers in a field of 9 potential candidates at the contest were held today, also asked the Iowans about New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, former Housing Secretary Julian Castro, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, California Senator Kamala Harris, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg, and Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. For some reason, the poll did not include Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, or Bernie Sanders. So, Jim, it's...
Well, don't include anybody who might actually win.
So, obviously, if 2016 was any indication, the demand for Martin O'Malley to run again is just overflowing.
You know, somebody did a profile of O'Malley lately, and he summarized his entire experience in 2015 and 2016 as nothing made sense. And you kind of have to – you almost want to give him a hug, right? That he's kind of the – because imagine if somebody – the fortune teller comes to him. It's the Ides of March. It fits very well today. And somebody says, oh, Martin O'Malley, be careful. If you run, you know, you're going to be way behind Hillary. And you might say, okay, well, she's got big advantages in terms of name ID, in terms of a financial network. You could argue everybody in Clinton world has been expecting this since 2008. So maybe I could, and you'll come in way behind Bernie Sanders. Who? Say what? The Larry David guy, you know, and you know, Martin O'Malley could point to two terms in which most of the state of Maryland did not crash into the Atlantic Ocean. Yes, Baltimore burned to the ground in some parts. It was not a, you know, from where we sit, it was not an illustrious record of executive governance, but you're up against Hillary and Bernie Sanders. You'd think that might, you know, count for a little something. You know, obviously he flames out, doesn't do anything in the Iowa caucuses, can't, you know, barely is – nobody remembers him from the debate stage, is afraid to really take a punch at either one of his big rivals. And when you're distant – when you're a distant, distant third, you really can't gain traction by not attacking either one of the people ahead of you. So you kind of recognize, but here's the, Matt, so you're Martin O'Malley. You have two terms as governor, as mayor of Baltimore, where things are maybe sort of kind of getting better. You have two terms as governor of Maryland. Your designated successor loses to Republican Larry Hogan in the 2014 midterms. Larry Hogan is currently, I believe, the most popular Republican governor in the entire country. Now, some of this is because he survived cancer and is a very nice guy. He's not terribly pro-Trump. He's not a bomb thrower. Larry Hogan is kind of the big, lovable, huggable teddy bear of Republican governors. But it looks like he's got a very good shot. So what is Martin O'Malley supposed to do with his life right now? I mean, there's kind of been this natural stepping stone, mayor, governor, president. And when you get so completely cut off at the knees in your effort at presidency, like the only thing he can think of is to try again. And I my sneaking suspicion, I'm sorry, Governor O'Malley, it's not really going to there's no reason to think that things are going to dramatically change in the way people see you 3 or 4 years from now. If anything, I think Democrats are going to be tempted to further. It's not that shocking that he puts in Schultz and Mayer in there and CEOs. I think Democrats will be very tempted to run their own non-traditional candidate. You can hear the names being floated around. Oprah, Mark Zuckerberg, Will Smith, you know, Denzel Washington, you know, some Hollywood star. There'll be a lot of people saying, hey, wait a second. If Republicans looked outside of normal politics and managed to succeed, why would the Democrats do this? And so Martin O'Malley has this entire resume and skill set that suddenly doesn't have a value in presidential politics anymore. So I, as much as I really enjoy making fun of Martin O'Malley, and he's largely got this coming to him, I do want to hear this kind of thing, kind of like, I kind of want to give him a hug. Like, Martin, let's talk about late career changes late in life. Let's find something else you can do with your life besides running for president. Because I understand you look at the Republican side, and there are a lot of guys who run every 4 years and stuff like that. But unless you want to reinvent yourself as a Pat Paulson joke candidate who runs every 4 years, you really need to find something else to do with your life.
Trying to remember in my head how many times he metaphorically wanted to give Martin O'Malley a hug during the 2016 campaign, and it looks like we're off to an early start in 2020 as well.
I know we should really dislike him, but there just seems something inherently sad about him. Martin O'Malley, 2020. Just acknowledge him.
He just wants you to know he's there. Jim.
I exist. I exist, and so do you. It's a very, very existential philosophy type presidential campaign.
It's a lot to fit on a bumper sticker, but he's got 4 years to figure it out. Jim, have a good one. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.